the section Jesus heals two demon-possessed men. And when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs, so fierce that no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them. And the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs. And behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled, and going into the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. Amen.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much, and may I add my warm welcome. It's lovely to be here at the Amber Nightclub. It's not somewhere where I regularly find myself, but it's great to be here with you, and thank you for coming. Goodness in an age of evil. There can be no doubting that we live in an age where really bad things happen. I live just 500 metres away from the Borough Market, where the attacks took place on Saturday the 3rd of June last year. And I remember waking sporadically through the night, hearing the helicopters hovering above, aware that something awful must have happened. And I, probably like many of you, can vividly recall 9/11 and 7/7, because my daughter was at school just a couple of hundred yards away from here in central London, and unobtainable by telephone. As you can imagine, it caused considerable consternation back at home. But the pure evil of these terrorist attacks that we've been faced with recently, mixed with the perverted wickedness of, say, a Rochdale abuse, and the abusive power, say, of Hollywood or the West End or Westminster, together with the recent hypocrisy that we've had unearthed in Oxfam and UNICEF, all these are very real, strong evidences of evil in this world. And I have to say that in my job and my previous job, I've encountered aspects of humanity so grotesquely wicked as to be unrepeatable. I think of my time in the army, and really it is unspeakable of what soldiers can get up to when faced with large amounts of alcohol and considerable boredom. And then there are the things of which one becomes aware that take place on foreign business trips here in the city, or after big nights out, or indeed back home in people's homes. And that's before we begin to explore, you know, the Savile Inquiry or John Warboys or Fred and Rosemary West and all these kind of things. So there's no doubt that despicably wicked things happen in our world. Back in the 70s, 80s and 90s, it became fashionable, alongside the view that human beings are essentially good and on an evolutionary path to greater and greater decency, simultaneously to hold the view that there is no such thing as a personal supernatural force for evil. And in those decades, the concept of a devil or of Satan was considered rather sort of primitive and unsophisticated for the Western mind. And therefore it was taught that and believed that with sufficient economic and financial progress and with adequate education and social intervention, we would bring about the advance of humanity and an escape from the worst aspects of human evil. Do you know, I even have an essay on my shelves at home written by the famous humanist Julian Huxley, The New Divinity, A New Religion. And in it he argues against any supernatural involvement or existence at all, and he argues simply for intervention by medical, psychiatric and so forth means. Now, I want to suggest that it's pretty hard to hold that position in 2018 unless you're going to stick your head in the sand. See, none of what people hoped for in the 70s, 80s and 90s has actually happened. We're certainly more educated than we ever have been, and we're better off than we ever have been, and there's more state social intervention than we've ever known. And yet evil. So how do we make sense of this human wickedness? Is it just that there are one or two bad apples in the barrel? That's often what people say. Well, they're inevitably, they're just one in every pot, then every company, they're one or two bad apples. But then what about the things that you and I think and say and do in our worst moments? Is it just that then that some of me is good and some of me is bad, and we have to do what Jamie Carragher is saying we have to do, find the better side of me? Or is it that alongside the wonderful good things that you and I are capable of, there is a serious and sinister force for evil in this world, a personal force that opposes God and his goodness in this world, and that we find ourselves confronted with it? You know, back in the 1990s, there were one or two voices who kind of railed against the gathering momentum of the Western liberal worldview. People like Bernard Levin, who some of you will remember, used to be a leader writer for the Times. And I remember him saying this after the Bulger murder. "We don't believe in the devil any longer, do we? He certainly believes in us." And in the same week, I'd just begun preaching, so I used to cut these sort of things out of the newspaper in those days, so I thought it was so interesting. In the same week, Libby Purvis was also writing for the Times at that time, "How can we go on holding that humanity is on an upward progression and that there is no supernatural force for evil, while simultaneously, everywhere we look, evil continues to raise its head? You can only keep your head in the sand for so long before it becomes obvious what kind of bird you are." I mean, isn't it interesting that many of the Hollywood producers, so much in the news, and numerous of the ISIL operators, and the Oxfam directors and cabinet ministers so plastered over our front pages, have received some of the finest education this world has got to offer? Well, I want us to turn to this incident that we just had read, if we could please, on page 21, Jesus' healing of the two demoniacs. And it comes, as Alfie said, in a section of Matthew's account of Jesus' life. Matthew was an eyewitness and a disciple of Jesus Christ, and I personally have no doubt at all that this actually took place. Matthew is a very careful historian, and he displays utmost attention to detail in what he writes. And I want to suggest that both Matthew and all the other writers of the New Testament present a much more credible view of the world than the view that we were presented with in the 80s, 90s and so forth. They hold that there is a real, personal, supernatural force for evil in this world. That our own selves, people like you and me, respectable, middle class, 21st century individuals, are vulnerable to the devil, and that we willfully take decisions to reject God's perfect rule influenced by him. Now, the incident is recorded in verses 28 to 34. You can see under the heading there. And I want us to notice, first, the authority of Jesus and deliverance from evil. And secondly, the deliverance of Jesus and a decision for good. Let's start with his authority and deliverance. The country of the Gadarenes, you read there, was a region to the east of the Lake of Galilee. It's outside of Israel's geographic borders. It was a place where superstition and pagan practices, together with black magic, animistic religion, would have abounded. And the two men we come across here are beyond any human aid. Verse 28, when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met Jesus coming out of the tomb, so fierce that no one could pass that way. Now, I know these are two extreme examples, and it shouldn't surprise us that when Jesus, the ultimate authority for good, God, enters his world, it's rather like when you stick a stick into an ant's nest. Suddenly all sorts of things are stirred up in opposition. Notice that these two individuals come out from the tombs. And that on its own tells a story, for Satan's work is to bring death. Not only do these individuals live amongst the dead, they are isolated, unclean, cut off beyond the help of the living. So it tells a story, doesn't it? They come out from the tombs. Notice that they are so fierce that no man can control them. That paints a picture also, doesn't it? We have to imagine these individuals with kind of spit dribbling down their unkempt beards, so wild-eyed, strong and uncontainable that no human being can get a grip of them. This is completely out of control. The whole area where they roam has become a no-go zone. We can imagine the fear of parents as they warn their children where they should and shouldn't travel on their own. You can picture the trepidation of the local authorities. They've given up trying to maintain law and order on that estate. And immediately, did you notice this? These two recognize the power and authority of Jesus as supreme. Isn't it interesting that supreme evil is sometimes much more spiritually perceptive than we are? Behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now, how did they address Jesus? O Son of God. The words Son of God are as much an honorary title as a job description. God's universal, everlasting, absolute King is given the title the Son of God. It's like calling someone Your Royal Highness, but on steroids. And so they spot straight away who Jesus is, and they beg Jesus to spare them. They can see his authority over evil. Verse 30, a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged Jesus, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." Just a word, no bell, book and candle, go. And they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. Now, I know that the destruction of the pigs causes us real concern, so it should. But please notice that it's not Jesus who destroys them. It's the demons. So the suicidal stampede of the swine shows simply the supernatural strength of Satan and his destructive force. Are we afraid of the devil? Do we fear Satan? Are we troubled by evil? We should be. But surely the point of the incident is very clear. Yes, the Son of God has broken into his creation. I hope you don't still have that faith position that there is no creator. The idea that something came from nothing is a bizarre idea. It takes a huge amount of faith to believe it, that this whole universe was created by nobody and just emerged by chance. That is a very, it's an interesting faith position. The point, though, is clear. Yes, there is a personal supernatural force for evil. Yes, this force is fearful beyond our imagining. Yes, Satan is unutterably destructive. And he will demolish whole cultures, whole families, whole cities with his demonic deceit. And in his wake, yes, he brings isolation and uncontrollable abuse of power and selfish greed and the disintegration of social networks and the smashing of families and the destruction of friendships and the removal of trust from whole cultures, including the city of London. Oh yes, there's an extraordinary power for evil. And it's interesting, isn't it? Now we've lost the language of the devil, we're lost for words. We just don't know what to say anymore. The tabloid headlines, they don't have the vocabulary. But in an age of evil, yes, there is one power, one authority, one absolute strength, one supreme force for good, and his name is Jesus. Now, it may be at this stage that we don't need to travel any further. For some of us, it may well be that there are many here who are deeply conscious of our own vulnerability to evil. The Bible actually speaks of three forces for evil in the world. The world, that's our whole cosmos and our human cultures as we develop without reference to God. The flesh, that's the internal me without God as I resist God. And the devil, the world, the flesh, and the devil. It may be that you are acutely conscious of your own vulnerability to the world, the flesh, and the devil. It may well be in some ways. I hope you are. Because that's the only thing that will make you flee to Jesus. And maybe you wouldn't, I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't describe yourself in terms of these two demoniacs. They're deliberately, intentionally extreme. But you'd certainly see yourself as the townspeople might, fearful. And, you know, every time I speak on a passage like this in the New Testament, of which there are many, I find people coming up to me afterwards and speaking about their own personal vulnerability to the world, the flesh, and the devil. My own demons. My own shackles. Some habit or power or substance. An overwhelming greed or ambition. Some hidden habit. Pornography, whatever it happens to be. And so it may be at this stage I don't really need to go any further, because, you know, we're very, very conscious of our own vulnerability. And the point of this incident is quite simply to show us that Jesus has absolute authority over evil. The whole part of Matthew's Gospel, Matthew 8 through 10, Matthew 8 and 9 are designed specifically to show us that he is God's king, that he's got absolute authority. We looked at his authority over creation last week. Now we have his authority over this, over the devil. And the next passage is over disease and ultimately over death. And as I mentioned last week, these incidents are impregnated, if you like, with one simple command. You can see it there in verse 22 over the page, page 20. Jesus said to him, "Follow me." And then you turn over the page to page 22. Sorry, that was page 20. Page 22, Matthew, verse 9. Do you see Jesus calls Matthew? As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in his tax booth. This is the author of the gospel. And he said, "Follow me." And so in amongst this profound authority of Jesus, his absolute authority over evil, follow me, follow me, follow me. So it may be that for some of us here today, I don't know most of you from Adam or Eve. And therefore I don't know what's going on in your life. But it may well be that we're already prepared to come to Jesus and ask for this deliverance that he's offering as we do what Matthew himself did and surrender to the command and authority of Jesus. But I want to drill down in the next few moments into the last three words of verse 29. So if you've lost where we are, we're on page 21. And I want us to look at the last three words of verse 29, the demon-possessed man. "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" You see, you may be saying something like this. Look, okay, I'm prepared to believe that Jesus did demonstrate his absolute power over evil. And I can see this first point, authority and deliverance. But if that's the case, how come there's still so much evil today? How come in 2018 we don't see a genuine reversal of all that so substantially spoils our world? Look at those last three words. "Have you come here to torment us before the time?" So I want us to move from the first point, authority and deliverance, to the second point, deliverance and decision. We haven't got time to look at all the Bible says about the devil, but in the Bible, in the third chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 3, we meet Satan for the first time. From the get-go, Satan's work is to deceive and to destroy and to bring death. Satan tempts men and women to reject God's good and loving rule. God has provided everything we need in his world, but he is supremely in charge. And Satan says, "Come on, take the good stuff and leave the giver." And the mark of a culture, actually, in the grip of Satan, is not that that culture is obsessed with voodoo or Ouija boards or the stuff of Friday the 13th. It is that that culture rejects God. Inevitably, that's the mark of a culture in the grip of Satan. We say no to God, we say no to Jesus Christ. But in Genesis 3, God promises that he will send one who will crush the head of Satan. That there will be a destroyer, a crusher. And I've jotted down that reference. I think it's there on your handout. He shall crush your head, you shall bruise his heel. And these demon-possessed men, they recognize Jesus as the Satan crusher. Have you come here to torment us before the time? They see that Jesus is the epitome of all that is good and pure and perfect. They acknowledge his supreme power over evil. And they see that he has, if you like, stepped onto the field of play early, before the appointed time. And then he demonstrates, yes, he is the one who will destroy Satan. He has all God's authority. With this, if you like, before the time display of his authority. Now, we've only looked at a couple of incidents over these last 2 weeks. We've looked at the calming of the storm, and we've looked at the driving out of the demons from these two individuals. But Matthew's aim is to show us Jesus, the Satan crusher. I don't know if you've ever been into one of those building sites where they've been building away. The place is absolute chaos, but they prepared a show home. Have you ever been into one of those? And they were building round a corner from us in our place down in just south of the river near Borough. And they'd been building for months and months and months. Eventually, they had the show home up, and these flats were going to be worth 1.5 million for a two. You know what it's like in this part of London. So it was extraordinary. Anyway, my wife and I, Jan and I, said, well, we're going to go and have a look. So we booked up for opening day, Saturday, whatever it was. We piled in. Guess what we found there? All our neighbours. You know, we were all so nosy. We knew absolutely nobody was going to buy a flat in a million years. They were looking at us, didn't know the vicar had a 1.5 million quid to spend and all the rest of it. But, you know, there in the chaos was this beautiful show home. Mud, filth and all the rest of it. Beautiful. And Jesus came, notice, before the time. He stepped into history before the appointment. Yes, he will crush Satan's head. And his resurrection at the end of it demonstrates that. We'll look at that in 2 weeks' time. If he rose from the dead, he's conquered death. If he's conquered death, Satan has been defeated ultimately. And his resurrection demonstrates that Jesus Christ has this absolute authority and he's entered into this world ahead of time. This time of year, you know, the snowdrops come up. Some of you from out in the country have probably seen the odd snowdrop, the tulip. What does it say to you? Summer's coming. Okay, then it chips it down with the beasts from the east for another couple of weeks. All right, but summer's on the way. The coming of Jesus into the world. Yes, there is hope in this world of evil. But we are then left with a key decision, aren't we? Authority and deliverance. Deliverance and decision. The question then comes, which side am I on, if I may put it like this? I realise this, it becomes really very, very impertinent, but I don't think you can get away from it in Matthew's Gospel. I think that's what he's wanting us to ask. Okay, so which side are we on? No denying the beauty of Jesus, the goodness of Jesus, the authority of Jesus, the power of Jesus. No denying it. Will you follow him? And if I won't follow him, then even if I say, well, I'm a bit agnostic, I must have been duped, surely. I mean, if there is supreme good and supreme evil, and I recognise evil for being supreme evil, and I recognise that Jesus is supremely God, and I won't follow him wholeheartedly with all that I have. You have to say, which side are you on? Do you see? So the power to deliver brings a demand for decision. And that's what's running through this whole section. Now, you know, we've just got 20...